This is the annual youth service, and our high school students are taking part in the whole service, as you can tell, and three of them have written statements that I'm then reflecting on for my homily. So I'd like to introduce the first of those three now, Megan Blau.
Gardener. Plants wilt after a few days in my house. I have managed to kill cacti and aloe vera plants. I have a brown bum. So last year, when I acquired four plants for a science project, I feared for their lives. Yet, after well over a year, they are not only alive, but thriving. And when, during last month's hailstorm, which I'm sure you all remember, all their pretty yellow flowers were broken off, I was kind of upset. But I realized that while I was not a gardener, I did enjoy it a little. I found a small piece of myself, and it was nice. I know that's not surprising. At my current age, it's hardly uncommon to be finding yourself. But what about later? Growing up is usually thought of as a process throughout your childhood and teenage years. But I doubt any of you would tell me we just hit 21 and stagnate. So what is growing up? A physical, mental, or emotional thing? Sure, but these things are changing all our lives, not just in childhood, for better or worse. I want to keep growing up throughout my whole life, no matter what it means. I don't want to get complacent in the imagined knowledge that I know everything. I would like to keep discovering myself, no matter who I may find. I don't know much about plants. I'm not very good with them. Yet I was able, though all I did was leave them outside and water them every few days, to make them live and flower. And there was a very definite satisfaction in knowing that I was part of something like that. This experience has also left me with the knowledge that I may be able to do something, even if I don't think I'll be good at it. There's just no way of knowing beforehand, and an attitude of self-doubt tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Though the hail broke off their flowers, the plants remained green and healthy, and already have a few buds. If I can keep this in mind most of the time, then maybe I'll be able to blossom too.
Now in the center of our service, in the center of our lives, we make time to honor life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly.
The journey. One day you finally knew what you had to do, and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own. That kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save.
Our second high school student to share his reflection is Patrick McVitie Mill.
It was a difficult process they'll all have to go through. It stretches from the second you're born to your last moment of life. This is against what some people believe, that as soon as you become an adult, you're done growing up and can rest for the rest of your life. But we all grow up at various times in our life for each bit, and each bit of growing gets us closer to know what it's all about. Right now, our seniors are selecting which college they will go to for the next few years of their life. This can greatly affect what happened to them past year. The decisions that take place growing up that will affect and change our lives as we get closer to finding ourselves. Getting married, having kids, getting promoted, getting fired, the list of experiences goes on for quite some time. I found that my first time really growing up was right here in this very church, taking part in the Coming of Age program. I got to talk about how I felt about things, and I felt like I was older, like I had stepped up a notch on the course of my life. I had to sit and think about what I believed, what I wanted in life, and what I had to do to get there. The decisions I made will change what's going to happen from here on out. I feel that they serve an important purpose in our life. Growing up, learning, finding your true self, all of this is important, and I know that I have to think about what I do before I get to it. Even other creatures have places and times where they grow up, like dragons. Yes, dragons, just hear me out. They must go through steps that will set the course for the rest of their lives. They breathe their first breath of scorching hot flame, soar into the heavens, and look down upon the world. They let out their first blood-chilling roar that shatters rocks and makes even the bravest of knights go deaf. Each of these affects them, and whether they'll be the terrible dragon that destroys cities and eats knights for breakfast, or the gentle one that sits in the forest and helps lost travelers. The same thing happens with us. I recently had to choose between two high schools, a fine arts and a liberal arts and science one. This choice is going to affect how the rest of my life goes. I'm having different experiences, meeting different people, and taking different classes than if I made the other decision. Several years from now, I might be a completely different person because of this. Who knows? All we can do is wait and see. If one is lucky enough to choose between two or more jobs after college, each one will lead them down another path. Or what to do if someone or something close to you has passed on. What you do next can change the path of your life. Life is like a giant board game. We shape ourselves with every move of the piece, every roll of the die. Each pass of go, another event, another day, another hour, another second. Draw a card. You're fired. What now? Stick with unemployment, angry and depressed, or go out and find a new job. Or maybe you're happy about it. Each part of growing up has a different effect on everyone that can lead to finding yourself in the end. The end of this board game is different for everyone. Where you finally stop growing and find your true self is all a matter of the decisions we make and what happens because of them.
And our third high school student to share her reflections with us is Karen Farmer.
About five. My father was working off the Gulf Coast, counting birds on a small island for a nature conservancy group. One day, he decided to take me with him to one of these islands, and I was deeply impressed by the birds. I had no idea that this day would change the girl I had become. My father and the birds inspired such an awe at their power, beauty, and independence that I came to admire and often expect these same qualities in the people around me as well as myself. I would like to tell you about this day. That morning, we jumped in the motorboat. It does not matter which morning, for I was young enough then that each morning seemed the same, and the color of the sky and the worth of the day meant little. The thick sea air engulfed us and then dumped us off on the dock of Green Island, an island that to me never fit in the real world and never needed to. It just floated on an endless desert of anonymous shifting water. Here, I'd stomp over the dock to wait for my father as he carried the day's lunch and a pair of binoculars to meet me and grasp my hand. I carried the look of my father's steps, confident and firm, while his distracted eyes urged me to be silent. Among the wisping ghosts of birds, we climbed the ladder to the blind, a wooden creature, a shack on stilts, and sat inside, the slats crisscrossing to make little windows that framed the chaotic, asymmetrical, beautiful movement of the shorebirds. They yelled like mad to each other, the sounds of their clicks and claps lost in the cacophony, individuals calling to her chicks or calling to his mate. My father treated them like human beings, admiring their cascading wedding plumage, their striking color, their sound, and my father carried these memories. This was his job. He was paid to count them, to learn them, and to understand them. I heard the sounds of the birds come out of his mouth so many times that it seemed that he spoke like the birds, even when he spoke to me. In my mind, they both chattered in the same esoteric language I admired but could never touch. Without thought, I carried their sound. I preened my feathers, learned to dive and fly in the Gulf wind, and tried to speak with the paradoxical complexity and simplicity of their vital and pointed speech. I did these things so my father would see me that way, wanting him to watch me and to understand me. I wanted to carry their language so I could learn the only language my father ever knew, the language of their confidence, their dress, their dance. Like me, each bird danced for another, sky-pointing, their paired dipping beaks and necks making careful interpretive ink blots on the backdrop of smooth blue. In their excitement, they ruffled their wedding plumage, accentuating the curving vines of their necks, ruffling brilliant feathers, carrying a few away into the violent wind. Feathers whipped around and around this island, performing pirouettes like stumbling children, falling everywhere, and settling cool in the shade of a restless mesquite. Sometimes, their wide wings carried them into the wind as well, dipping and swooping low into the brush to nudge a chick or high into the air to spot a fish on the shallow gulf. As a bird watcher, my father followed their eyes, with weighty black binoculars, his body rigid and insistent. In the mornings, he just watched, observing color and size, and carried the imprints of the day in his mind. Not permitted to speak, I squirmed and tossed around in the blind, restless from waiting. I did not yet know why I liked being there, as the sun beat mad, looping patterns of heat into my skin and cells, which carried the boredom heavily, making me wild. In the sparse shade, we stopped to eat. And here, chin on my knees, between bites of a ham and cheese sandwich, crust strewn across the ground, I felt the ants must be more free. I imagined them sleeping under a dark, virgin sky, lit with the cold light of crisp stars. I imagined them sitting back in little restaurants the size of leaves and chatting about their tans and the feast of crust they had received earlier at lunch. The birds were like Greek gods, bickering about space and food as a hobby, as they watched and flew like creators, proud and contented over their kingdom. Every bird carried its young to maturity with lazy, comfortable guidance. The only limit was space, and they used every inch. Feathered shoulders almost touched, and every thorny branch provided a place to land. And yet these shorebirds didn't ever care about birds of any other species. Great egrets defended their territory against other great egrets, making threatening gestures with their long white necks, but a roseate spoonbill was virtually invisible to them. Each one seemed to carry the isolation of city people, with apartments like tiny stacked houses, separate and easily overlooked by other tenants. In the afternoon, after lunch, I ran down to the beach and sifted through the seaweed, soggy and ripe with salt, on the shore. Plovers and sanderlings wandered here as outcasts, tiny gray birds with short pointed beaks and plump bodies. They seemed like regional deities on such an island. Rushing in and out in a childish, giddy play, they carried the routine of water, the simple in and out of tides, with no need to watch or to observe. I'd never been one of these birds. I'd never loved one. I could only watch them as a child, fascinated but attached, detached, eyes wide and distracted from the cool stick in my hand and the foaming seaweed. Meanwhile, as shadows fell across the island, my father watched the birds come back from fishing and flight to roost, and he counted them. Hurrying back up the trail, I sat next to him in the blind, sun-soaked and wind-blown, to watch the last of the settling birds, their concave wings curved into a feathered embrace, into the relative harmony of sleep. Their chicks, awkward with newness, closed large eyes in a woven stick nest in the undergrowth. I marked our footsteps in the rich dirt, and then sand as we reached the dock, little feet and big feet, making a two-part rhythm in the wet wood. We carried our trash and belongings in a hush, for the noises of the birds negated our own. Even as night came, those creatures chatted on, and it made me wonder what they were talking about. Stepping back into the boat was the hardest part. The way it swayed in the shallow water as I put a foot in made it seem as if it did not want me back, and the feeling was mutual. But as a chore, as a ritual, I stepped in, one foot and then the other, balancing and glancing back at the island. My father joined me and started the motor, cutting the shallow, salty gulf and then the intercoastal waterway, slicing the sea in half. Streaming toward shore, I carried the smell that is so recognizable there, so unique. I've always thought it comes from the smell of birds, millions of birds living close, and the smell of salt crystallized on everything. The strange smell of rot taking the seaweed, the fish, and the birds. Off the boat and home, everything just seems so grounded. Just the grackles eating scattered dog food in the driveway. Just the ants following the same line in the dirt. No restaurants the size of leaves. No sleeping under the stars. Away from that place, the idea coats me like the filter of a camera. Not inventing color, but intensifying it. All the reds and greens and blues saturated and brilliant. Something happened within me that day that changed me. Now, in my heart, everyone is a bird. Because every bird is different, there must be, it seems, one match for every human. One that tends to cock its head. One that sings a complex tune. My father is the great blue heron, an intelligent, lanky shorebird dressed in lovely blues and whites and blacks.
and I am the green jay, a solitary, timid bird of the woods who wears tropical blues and greens. Now I carry that day everywhere. I carry the washed-out bleach of the sun, the harsh sea wind, and the screeching cry that birds make like humans, yelling at the summit of a mountain, yelling for something undefined, yelling for defiance and beauty and power. And whenever I'm alone, I carry my father's voice, whispering their names in the morning heat. I carry the taste of the shadows, delicate and crucial, under a great speckled egg.
It's hard enough to write a statement that you have to read in front of a room full of people staring at you, but when I met with these three students, I told them that I wanted them to do more than that, that I wanted them to write something that was a gift to you and that was about you as much as it was about them. Working with them, I was reminded of Khalil Gibran's poem on children, where he wrote, "Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself." All children are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come with their own personalities, their own styles, just as we did. And they seek ways to find a home in life and to serve it, and to serve this grand sense of life that longs for itself, just as we do. I see these annual youth services as a chance for grown-ups to look into both our future and our past. Our children struggle with the same questions and challenges that we once did. And hearing from them, as we have this morning, can remind us how much like them we really are and how much like us they are. We are also manifestations of life's longing for itself, and we also look for ways to find the dynamic and the creative powers in life, the powers around us and in us, to become a part of them, to become a part of this vast and transcendent sort of mystery. You can see this in all three of their statements. Megan began with an innate sense of honor for life and a reluctance to take on responsibility for life because she had decided that she had a brown thumb and that even cactus and aloe plants had lives who were in danger under her care. Well, if you don't think you can care for life well, you don't want to, because it's a sacred thing, and there's that awareness is absolutely deep in us. And it reminded me, since I free associate, of something I was reading this week, the same day that I was reading these statements. Two articles from the new issue of the magazine Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N. They're interesting articles by two women who are starting to frame a more accurate and quite different way of understanding abortion and birth. They show that choosing life or choosing abortion really isn't just choices about the new life. They're choices about whether we feel that we can do honor and justice to the new life. And they cited some statistics I'd never seen before. For instance, during Bill Clinton's very liberal presidency, did you know that the abortion rates in the United States fell by nearly 17%? And during George Bush's very conservative presidency, that abortion rates have risen by over 14%? Why is that? It's because young women and young couples are embedded in our national economy. When the economy is better, they believe that they can serve and honor and do justice to life, and they bring it forth. And when the economy beggars them, they feel that they cannot honor and do justice to life, and something in them makes that feel then like an immoral choice to bring it forth. Now, what a much more profound way and more honest way of understanding what's going on. And there were seeds of this kind of thinking, this awareness of life's innate sacrality and our responsibility to serve it or to say no if we can't serve it well. There were seeds of this in Megan's piece. When she felt she couldn't serve life, she didn't want to take it on. She didn't want any more plants. When she began to believe that she could, then she did. And that sense of life sanctity and the conditions that need to exist before we encourage it, that sense seems to lie very deep within us from a very early age, and it seems to be trustworthy. Megan was talking about plants, not human babies, and her point was about gaining faith in her abilities, faith that can give her more courage to engage more fully in the life ahead of her. But the implications of what she said are very far-reaching. Her piece could inspire a whole book of sermons. Patrick has a very different style from Megan. If he were a Hindu, I'd say his path is the path of Jnana Yoga, the path of trying to relate ourselves to life through understanding it, through understanding more profoundly how it's connected, how this connects with this, how this fits. You heard him trying to figure out how the choices we make have far-reaching effects on our life and the quality of our life far into the future. Patrick also brought in another wonderful dimension, the dimension of mythology as a source for the creative understanding of ourselves and our options. There are good dragons and there are bad dragons. And some of the difference comes from their choices. The good ones sit in the woods to help lost travelers. The bad ones just eat them. And as it is with dragons, so it is with us. How will the decisions Patrick makes help direct his life toward helping others rather than devouring them? How will ours? Is there ever a time in our lives when we aren't trying to sort things out like Patrick is? This is really what myths are for. It's also what religions are for. And it's also what good stories, movies, and comics are for, because these are our modern mythology. These are where we spin the stories that show us possibilities for life and the effects and implications of actions. We create the dragons, the princes and princesses, the action heroes. We create wisdom figures like Yoda in Star Wars. We create them as imaginative projections of our own sense of duty or courage, of whimsy or wisdom. We create dragons the way we create gods, and they come from the same places. The distance between gods and dragons isn't as far as you might think. Gods and demons come from the world where dragons live, and we often miss the insights they offer into ourselves and our lives. Patrick's reflections could also be the inspiration for a whole host of sermons and discussions. And think about Karen's piece. While she isn't referring to mythology, except in noting that the birds bickered like Greek gods, her poetic sense has described our world as a mythic stage. That was a mythic world that she was talking about, even though it was a real one. The poetry told you that you're in the land of myth. It's a mythic stage on which life's grandness struts in all of its many forms. She studied the birds the way Patrick looks at dragons, and the way Megan sees some plants surviving a hailstorm, reading them for insights into life, reading them for connections between life and herself. Karen's piece looks back while Megan's and Patrick's are looking more ahead. Karen kept the magic of the associations she made a dozen years ago on Green Island, the patterns she saw in birds and in people, the wondrous variety and vitality of life in all of its forms. All three of these teenagers have sensed something of the nearly magical powers of life, the many styles of it that we find and that we have to make sense of. They're all trying to find places within life to serve it, to honor, and to do justice to this spirit of life in the world around them and the spirit of life within them. They're grappling with the same deep callings, the same sensitivities, and the same needs as we are, aren't they? And let's take it into another era. Here are three people who are part of our future, trying to relate themselves and their decisions to causes and ideals that best serve the wonder and creativity and fragility of life. What if those considerations are taken into the way we look at our world? What if we ask whether our economy serves life or stifles and batters it, both here and abroad? Is that really changing the subject? What if we said that the only choices we could be proud of making were choices that honored those life-giving forces rather than the choices that devoured them like a dragon devouring knights? What if we looked at our international policies of war from this perspective? You may say, oh no, religion isn't about any of those things. It's only about personal things that stay inside our individual souls. We don't talk about the world in church. But not one of these three kids was talking only about themselves, not one of them. They were talking about how they can most creatively and proudly interact with all the world around them to honor the kind of life forces that they are already aware of. What if we encouraged our children to pursue this respect for the life-giving spirits in our world to the farthest extremes in the years ahead of them? What if we encouraged them to bring those considerations into every single decision they made in their lives? To encourage only economic policies that empower and enrich the greatest number of people? You think that's far-fetched? To sanction only wars that are absolutely necessary, and never to sanction wars undertaken to seize another nation's assets or use it as a launching pad for the invasion of its neighbor? Or if they insisted that the pictures of the dead and wounded of all our wars were always placed before our eyes by the media so that we might weep together? Is that far-fetched? What if we encouraged our children to think of every decision, large and small, as one that must be kept in harmony with these fragile and miraculous forces of life that they are all learning to see, to feel, to honor, and trying to serve? They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. What if we encouraged them to ensure that their life paths and life decisions also honored life's longing for itself? Friday night, night before last, about 80 people came to our second monthly movie night here. And one of the movies we saw was a 45-minute film by the Canadian scientist David Suzuki on the interrelatedness of us with everything, all life on Earth. At one point, he showed a film clip of his teenage daughter addressing an international assembly, a clip in which she was assailing the adults gathered there for not having made choices that served life and not offering her generation a healthy world. Afterwards, David said some adults came up to her to admit their failures and said that they were counting on her generation to fix things. She responded to them, he said, in two ways. First, she said, So that's your excuse for not doing anything. And then she asked how her generation was to do any better when the adults had been their role models. These awarenesses of life and our responsibilities to become loving parts of it, these awarenesses start very early. Little kids have them. Maybe they can't articulate them as well as these three did today until they get older. But even little kids have them. They're the questions whose pursuit makes us most human. And you've heard them in the reflections of all three of these high school students today. We hold these youth services once a year because we say that we want to honor our children. It might be worth our while to listen to them as well, because they're reminding us of the great idealism that we once had about life. Do you remember when you first discovered that you could actually serve life, and that doing so not only helped plants blossom, but also helped you blossom? Do you remember when you were awed by the implications of the choices you could make, how they would affect your life, and how you wanted to become like the good dragons rather than the bad ones or the indifferent ones? Do you remember when you entered easily and often into the world of birds or bunnies or horses or dogs, when you marveled at the great variety of life, and when you affirmed your own style within that variety, your own gifts, and you knew for the first time that you were a precious part of life just as everything else was? Then do you remember how you looked forward to a whole life ahead of you, looked forward to being a bigger part of life, of serving it, of loving it, and of blossoming? Do you remember?